Welcome to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast, the podcast where we talk about everything related to James Joyce's Ulysses. This is the 68th episode of that podcast, and I'm Kelly.
I'm Dermot.
How are you doing tonight, Dermot?
I'm doing well.
Thanks for coming out.
Oh, anytime.
We are a blog as well as a podcast, and I don't have a new post to announce tonight, but I've gotten most of the next post written, so I wanted to tease it just a little bit, and it's on the topic of incubism. What does incubism mean to you, Dermot?
An incubus being a demon that, I think an incubus is the male one that molests women in their sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a succubus is the female one mm-hmm. that molests men in their sleep.
Incubus is also an early 2000s rock band.
Hmm.
So it's about one of those two things.
Okay.
Let's find out which. But incubism is listed as the technic of the sixth episode of Ulysses, Hades.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm doing kind of a deep dive on that. So that's in the works. Be on the lookout for that on our social media or on our website, which is
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Or you can sign up for our newsletter and we'll send you a link. For our current podcast episode, though, we are talking about Orientalism. And Dermot has done some wonderful artwork for this. Could you tell us about your sketch for today's episode?
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while, so it's interesting to see it fresh, because I can see mistakes now, too, that I would change. But it's...
Don't tell the listeners that. Don't think it's perfect.
Every designer. It's Leopold Bloom, like the tarot card fool, and he's mm-hmm. about to walk off on a ledge. And he is surrounded by a magical phantasmagoria of his own imaginings, with minarets and mosques and flying carpets,
mm-hmm.
camels, all as this like Islamic curled. What's the word? There's a word for all this. Oh, my brain.
Arabesques.
And I'm very happy with that one. Put a lot of work into this.
Mm-hmm. I remember you getting compliments for this one online.
Mm. Yeah, nice color patterns too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very colorful. Not all of your drawings are in color, but this one is exceedingly colorful.
Yep.
And if our listeners would like to see your artwork,
bloomsandbarnacles.com. And I believe you have a gallery page on there too, so you can see
all. Yes, there's a page called, I believe, Bloomy Tunes, mm-hmm. and you can see all of Dermot's artwork there in one convenient location. So check that out if you're so inclined. All right, we've got a few shout outs. First of all, we'd like to thank anyone who donates to our show. And this week, we'd like to thank...
Ellen Murphy.
Thank you so much. We do appreciate your donation. And if any of our other listeners would like to donate to the show, how can they do that, Dermot?
Again, bloomsandbarnacles.com. Donate button, top right of the page. Easy to find.
We do appreciate it. If you'd like to keep up with Blooms and Barnacles, every month we send out a monthly newsletter at the top of the month. We give you a preview of some of our upcoming shows for the month, and we send you links for all the stuff that we posted within the past month. This is great for anyone who, like me, tries to avoid social media as much as possible. So if someone would like to sign up for our newsletter, where can they find that?
Again, bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Mm-hmm. All the way at the bottom of the homepage.
Strong recommendation to do it. Newsletters are the way of the future. You'd think they were from the 1990s.
They're the way of the past. That's also the way of the future.
They really work.
Yep. We've got a few listener comments here I'd like to share with you guys. First of all is a comment from a listener named RJ on the most recent podcast, which was about Bloom buying his kidney. And I'd like Dermot to read that comment.
Must say, do you like devil kidneys when on menu? Ask my wife of nearly 40 years, who's a great cook, to do steak and kidney pie for the first time in our married bliss. Butcher delivered on the kidneys and steak. This Thursday, I hope to be diving into one of the great Dublin staples, steak and kidney home cooked. Rock on, James Joyce.
I have to say, I've been a vegetarian for years, and I found that incredibly charming. And one other thing we like to do, and you get a preview of this too in the newsletter, is we put out a question of the month so that listeners can answer it. And the question for May, since this is in the run-up to Bloomsday, which we'll talk about a little bit after this, is for listeners to share a favorite Bloomsday memory, and we have this one from Rick.
After graduating college, I read Joyce's portrait. By the time June 16th rolled around that year, I was interested in trying to read Ulysses. I was working in a chain bookstore in St. Louis, but saw a flyer for a marathon reading of Ulysses on June 16th at Left Bank Books, a great independent bookstore in town. I wandered in around 7 or 8 o'clock. All these people were sitting and standing around with Ulysses in their hands, and copies of the novel and related books on the tables. I picked up a copy and somehow found out where the reading was at the moment, in the Nausicaa chapter. I stayed for maybe an hour. The next day, at work at my chain bookstore, I ordered Gifford and Sideman and Ulysses itself, employee discount, and began the first of three readings of the novel. Thanks for your podcast.
And thanks for your story, Rick. If anyone else has a fun, charming, or even horrific story of Bloom's Day, check out our social media for threads where you can post it, or just go ahead and email it to us at bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. Speaking of Bloom's Day, we're kind of using these stories to promote our own little Bloom's Day celebration for Bloom's Day 2021. We are gathering up readings of our listeners' favorite sections of Ulysses, and we would love to hear yours. So here's what you do. You think, hey, what section of Ulysses would I like to read? And then can you read it in around 5 to 7 minutes? Which is a guideline, not a hard and fast rule. And you think, yes, I can do that. Then head over to our website at
bloomsandbarnacles.com
and click on Bloom's Day 2021 to find out how to record and submit that to us. There's even a handy dandy spreadsheet link there so you can make sure that your awesome selection hasn't been selected by a different awesome person. And then email me and we'll set it all up. We would love to hear from you. Last year it was an absolute hoot. We heard from folks all over the world and we'd love to do that again. So if you'd like to participate, or if you have a friend who you think is kind of theatrical and would like to participate, send them our way as well. Share the link around. You've still got plenty of time to submit. We are taking submissions right up until the 13th of June. So get them in. I hope to hear from you in emails. Going forward then into our actual discussion. So I want to make a note about this week's topic. We've kind of been reading through Calypso, you know, page by page. And the episode I had planned for this week was about Bloom reading the prospectus for the Ogundot Netaim Planters Company prospectus and going a little bit into the history of Jewish settlements in Palestine in the early 20th century. But we've kind of decided we want to hold off on that topic for a while due to the current violence in the, you know, in that region of the world. I do intend to return to it sometime this summer because I do think understanding the history behind that little section of the book adds a great layer of historical context to Ulysses and also just helps you know what the heck Bloom is talking about as he repeats this phrase over and over throughout the book. I just don't feel like it would be appropriate right now. If you really were looking forward to this or you're just curious, I wrote a blog post last year called Ogundot Netaim and that you can read at our website right now, which is
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Yep, just go on there. It's in the section called blog. So instead, we're going to tackle a completely uncontroversial theme, which is Orientalism and colonialism and how those affect the mindsets of people living in Ireland in the early 20th century. So it was a topic I was kind of planning to hold off on until we reached Lotus Eaters, but, you know, here we are. And I really enjoyed this topic. I'm really proud of the post I wrote about it. So I hope you enjoy this. So let's do a reading from Calypso, Ulysses' fourth episode. In my edition of Ulysses, it's found on page 57, my edition being the 1990 Vintage International Edition. It's a little bit of a backtrack. We've kind of read through this already, but now we're going to get down and dig into it. So Dermot's going to read that. Go for it, Dermot.
Somewhere in the east, early morning, set off at dawn. Travel round in front of the sun, steal a day's march on him. Keep it up forever, never grow a day older technically. Walk along a strand, strange land, come to a city gate. Sentry there, old rank or two. Old Tweedy's big moustaches, leaning on a long kind of a spear. Wander through on streets, turban faces going by, dark caves of carpet shops. Big man, Turco the Terrible, seated cross-legged, smoking a coiled pipe. Cries of sellers in the streets. Drink water scented with fennel, sherbet. Dander along all day. Might meet a robber or two. Well, meet him. Getting on to sundown. The shadows of the mosques among the pillars. Priest with a scroll rolled up. A shiver of the trees signaled the evening wind. I pass on. Fading gold sky. A mother watches me from her doorway. She calls her children home in their dark language. High wall. Beyond, strings twanged. Night sky, moon, violet. Color of Molly's new garters. Strings. Listen. A girl playing one of those instruments. What do you call them? Dulcimers. I pass. Probably not a bit like it, really. Kind of stuff you read in The Track of the Sun.
All right, thank you, Dermot. Any thoughts on this passage?
He's having like a completely imaginative daydream about being on a trip through a Middle Eastern city with all of the Orientalist tropes of minarets and, yeah, like, I'm surprised there isn't Turkish Delight in there somewhere.
Yeah, that kind of like the stuff in your image that you did.
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah, so this is kind of Leopold Bloom. He is walking to buy the kidney. So this is before the part in the last episode where he buys the kidney. Mm-hmm. My God, this book is riveting. It really is, though. I enjoy it a lot. And this is just kind of his daydream as he goes from point A to point B. Mm. You know, before he hits that corner where Larry O'Rourke's is. And yeah, so this is just him thinking to himself. Mm-hmm. So, Orientalism is a word we've been throwing around here. Orientalism, which we will define momentarily here, is usually, I would think, something that you would see as part of the mindset of a colonizing power, like an imperial power. Like, let's say the British Empire. We're gonna pick on the British anytime we talk about anything imperial or colonial because they're, you know, kind of tangled up in the whole Ulysses thing. However, the Irish were a colonized people. Ulysses is written by an Irishman and about Irish people. So what has Orientalism got to do with Ireland? So on one hand, the Irish were oppressed by a colonial government. 1904 is still 12 years before 1916. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, aspects of British culture were part of everyday life for most Dubliners, and especially, you know, middle-class Dubliners like the Blooms. So the culture of the day reflected the expansiveness of the British Empire around the globe, right? The empire upon which the sun never set. The Orient in particular held a special allure in the imaginations of both British and Irish folks, and since Ulysses is couched so firmly in this time period, it's really no surprise that there is a very strong Oriental, or I like to say Orientalist, motif running throughout the novel. And I've seen people comment when I brought this up online that there's no way that Joyce could have been an Orientalist or have this skewed vision because I'm trying to think of the particular complaint that he would have lacked the chauvinism of the British mindset because he was Irish. Mm. What do you think about that? You're Irish, right?
Yeah, that's not an argument.
What's your argument?
Well, I've also heard people who consider themselves left liberal to criticize the Irish for being involved in the British Empire, like it was our idea or we sort of capitulated to it. So the other extreme of stupidity. And if you pull on that thread too hard, it'll unravel an awful lot of stuff that you won't want unraveled because basically it's a form of victim blaming. Mm. I mean, every colonized people take on attributes of the dominant power and it can be soft power as well. Like look at how American culture is spread around the world and that's just a soft imperial power in that case, along with the fist of the military too. In the case of the British Empire, a lot of the stuff that came into Ireland from the British Empire was, you know, we like this. This product is good. We like the, you know, these things. We'll take them. The Irish love soccer. You know, one of my school friends when I was a kid was banging on about how much he hated England. And I said, I knew his favorite football team was Man United. So I said, what's your favorite football team? And he grinned and he went real quiet. And then he said, Shamrock Rovers. I'm like, you liar. So you are born into a matrix. You're going to take, it's like a fish in water. You don't know the water exists. It's just something you assume is the normal way of being. And a lot of Irish people are more English in some respects, or more English than they would be American because of the proximity and the amount of people who come back and forward, including members of my family. I have English cousins and they're born in England. Their dad, my uncle, was Irish, but he married an English woman. The kids are born in England. They speak with Preston, you know, Lancashire accents. They're English, but they have an Irish dad. They can be Irish if they want, but they want to move there. But it's not this like rigid line that the Orientalist worldview would create also, that it's us and them, A or B. And then you begin to apply these essentialist characteristics onto one or the other. So there's this kind of flow of cultural themes and ideas and thoughts from one into the other. So you have to be very careful about talking about Ireland like it's this fixed, rigid thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, my whole thing is to look at the world as a continuum, and I train myself to do it every day, and I'm always being pulled back into non-continuum thinking processes because that's what your brain wants to do. And Korzybski, who founded General Semantics, called this the consciousness of abstraction. Your mind always wants to abstract on the continuum and make rigid categories, and you have to push back against the rigid categories because you will become hypnotized by them. And that's what happens when people have an Orientalist worldview or a non-Orient, the counter side, the other side too, who want to blame everything on the British Empire. They're also engaging in this form of essentialism, an abstraction. So you'll cast a spell on yourself and it'll stop you from seeing how porous a lot of these systems are, not to let the British Empire off the hook for anything they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, we're not about to do that today.
We will not do that today or any other day or any other empire for that matter. But
what I want to get across is that the Irish, particularly Dublin middle and upper classes, were very much swimming in British, specifically English culture.
Very heavily. Mm-hmm. And the more money you made, the greater the chances that you would have been pulled into that cultural sphere. Mm-hmm. And like even today, the Irish ruling class, with the exception of Sinn Féin, the Irish ruling class today, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, all those parties, I guarantee you, they're always looking to London. They're always following British politics. And secretly, right, they're always thinking, oh, what
any
are,
emails
what are they doing?
That I get about Irish politics and your opinions, I'm going to forward to you. I'm choosing not to answer.
That statement's not controversial. I think.
Okay.
Well, insofar as it like relates to 1904 and 2021, mm-hmm, as when we're talking.
Yeah. I'm teasing you a little bit. Yeah, no, I think that sometimes people, and in just my personal experience, Irish-American people tend to see a very hard line between Irish people and British people, but there's that Venn diagram overlaps pretty heavily, I think.
Yeah.
And how could it not? Like that, you know, that's part of the project of colonialism is to subsume one culture in another. And I mean, we talked about Mr. Deasy, how people often confuse Mr. Deasy and think he's either British or from Northern Ireland, from Ulster, but he's actually meant to be representative of a wealthy Dubliner who is a West Brit, I think was the term. All right. Well, let's not worry about Britain for right now. Let's talk about the Orient, which I think is definitely a word that has fallen out of favor, but we have to talk about it here. And you'll see why, because we're going to talk about Orientalism. So let's start with a definition of terms. What is the Orient? And the answer to what is the Orient is most places. The Orient encompasses a vast swath of geography and culture, and it could potentially reference East Asia, India, the Islamic world, Israel, North Africa, and even in some reckonings, Spain, Greece, and other areas of Eastern Europe. I always thought it meant like roughly like East Asia, like China, Korea, Japan, but when I started to dig into this, it's basically everywhere that isn't Western Europe and even some parts of Western Europe.
Yeah.
It becomes a very unwieldy term very quickly as a result because it's not terribly descriptive of anywhere in particular. The vast majority of people on Earth would live in the Orient under this, you know, definition. It's home to hundreds of cultures and languages and dozens of religions. And you know, it can't possibly describe everyone and everything in that region of the globe. So it could be said that the Orient simply means those guys over there, not us, them, from the viewpoint of Western Europe.
Yeah.
What the term Orient does describe is an opposition or a difference to the Occident or the West. The term Orient, therefore, implies East, but only in relation to Europe, really. So anything east of Europe, depending on how you define Europe. And in keeping with the imprecise nature of this term, the place is labeled quote-unquote, Oriental, don't necessarily even have to be east of Europe. They just need to be not Europe. And this is due to the term's roots in European colonialism.
Hooray.
Orientalism and the Orient, the idea of the Orient, has a lot to do with the exotic... I'm going to say this word. The is... Exotic. Exoticization of the peoples and cultures found in the Orient. That is a word that I wrote and never pronounced until now. So it's the idea that the Orient is more exotic than Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that a faraway place must be populated by mysterious and inscrutable inhabitants. This is at the very core of Orientalism. So then the East takes on a mythical quality. It's a land full of monsters. Remember pards?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. If you don't know about pards, that is...
Leopards crossbred with chimpanzees or something?
No. Leopards are a cross between lions or Leo and pards, which are not real.
Okay.
That's in a past episode.
Okay.
The East then could also be a sort of Edenic paradise full of bounty, ripe for the taking. Perhaps a virgin territory just waiting to be explored or exploited. Orientalism as a concept is laid out in great detail in the 1979 book Orientalism by Edward Said. It's what I'm basing a lot of my definitions and descriptions on are his writings, and you're going to hear his name a lot in this and probably future episodes. The key to understanding Orientalism, as emphasized by Said, is difference. That's the big deal. Difference. Their thing is different from my thing. My thing is normal. Their thing is weird. My thing is logical and sensible. Their thing is weird and strange. And what lies in the Orient is other, for better or for worse, than the normal, familiar experiences of the West. The Orient, then, is an invention of the colonial mind, since it can only exist in opposition to the Occident, as we mentioned. So it's kind of whatever you want it to be. Like, whatever you need to project onto people you think feel a little too foreign, that's what the Orient becomes.
Yeah, it's a white page, and you never see what's there. And it's a screen, and you project your dreams and your nightmares onto it. And it's hard to remember now, but in the 19th century, it was a dream catcher. It was, you know, all these 1001 Nights, Aladdin, wonderful. They didn't have Lord of the Rings yet, so Arabia filled in for that. And by the late 20th century, it's a projection holder for Western nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
And all the horrible things that happened there, sure, but we're going to amplify it in their mind. And every person's going to be basically a suicide bomber or a terrorist. Mm-hmm. And it's just the Western mind just pours all of its unconscious fears into the long-suffering Middle East in this case. A friend of mine, I worked in China for 4 weeks in 1994, talking about the inscrutable, because it's the cliche, right? The inscrutable Oriental. And so it was three of us, me, an English guy, and another Irish guy, Gary. And Gary's sweetheart, but big. And he was the director of the project. And I found out in week three that all of the Chinese people in the studio were terrified of him. And I thought, how on earth could you be terrified of Gary? He's a big teddy bear. And I thought, is it because he's like 6.5 feet tall, you know? And they said, no, his expression never changes. And I thought, oh, the inscrutable Occidental, right? Like they just, but it wasn't inscrutability. Yeah. They couldn't read his cultural facial cues and tics, or like fractional rays of an eyebrow or whatever. So there was this kind of gap of body language. But that kind of thing me about, yeah, don't take these cliches at face value because that's all they are.
Yeah, I remember something. I lived in Asia for 8.5 years in 3 different countries. Mm. And the one complaint I would hear over and over and over and over and over again is that people X can't do task Y because they lack logic. The one that stands out most in my mind was I worked for an NGO in Cambodia for the better part of 2011. And they were trying to lay tile in one of our buildings. And the Australian running the project griped very loudly that the Cambodian workers couldn't do it or lay the tile straight because they lacked logic. And I was like, maybe they need a better supervisor.
I heard similar things when I was in China. Let it be noted that 3 days prior to this recording, China landed a rover on Mars.
Yeah. All right. Well, we picked enough. We picked on enough people from our memories. Let's pick on the British.
Yeah.
And the British imperial worldview. So this worldview held that British culture was on the upward end of a curve of progress. Mr. Deasy. Having embraced a rational mindset, the British were able to develop superior science, industry, and technology, which ensured their superiority as a culture in the world generally. Therefore, the colonized people, the people who were colonized by the British, were simply not as advanced as the British Imperials, and their cultural inferiority to the British and uncivilized manner had to be corrected and improved by the technological and intellectual superiority of British culture. Colonialism then also carried a moral component. In short, a drive to civilize the savage people around the world, especially those in the Orient.
White man's burden nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wait till we apply this logic to soap advertising. Once we get to Lotus Eaters. Mm-hmm. There's a post about that on our blog already.
Just note, the British culture was on the upward end of a curve of progress idea. There's a formal name for that as the Whig interpretation of history, if anybody wants to read about that horror show.
Mm-hmm. All right. And we could all use a little more horror show in our our leisure time. All right. The Orient, as Dermot so aptly pointed out, is a dream. Edward Said saw the Orient as it exists in the minds of Westerners as the focal point of the dream state, a sort of faraway utopia where Westerners can feed their spiritual needs, find themselves, or satisfy their adventurous spirit free from the restraints of civilization, quote unquote. This spirit can be found in the poetry of Byron, as well as contemporary books and movies like Eat, Pray, Love or The Darjeeling Limited are two that come to mind.
And an infinite supply of influencers on Instagram who go and get themselves photographed at holy shrines and whatnot.
Yeah. The Orient is a land of heightened sense and experience, a place better than real life. So here's a key question. What has all this got to do with Ulysses? So R. Brandon Kirshner described Ulysses as, quote, a compendium of Orientalist cliches. He stated that the novel contains more allusions to 1001 Nights than the Odyssey, and in his view, Stephen and Bloom are far more likely to frame their Bloomsday journey in terms of Sinbad the Sailor than Odysseus. They even meet an Irish Sinbad the Sailor in the form of Sailor Murphy in the cabin shelter in Eumaeus, which you have not read yet. Though, as we learn at the end of Ithaca, Bloom is the real Sinbad and the Odysseus. Although, Odysseus is kind of Oriental too, I guess, by a very, broad definition. Mm. Or maybe Bloom is Harun al-Rashid and is having adventures by night in an Irish Baghdad. Any of this resonating?
Yeah.
Okay. So that brings us to Bloom's Orientalist Daydreams, which we read one, and let's look at that little bit of text. Bloom's flights of fancy rescue him from the drudgery of day-to-day errands, as well as the crushing pain of Molly's infidelity and his crumbling marriage. So Bloom's life may be slipping beyond his control, but he can cobble together a mysterious Orientalist fantasy land from odds and ends kind of cluttering his memory, right? The Orient is a dream.
Yep.
It's whatever you want it to be. Heightened sense and experience, better than real life. That's what Bloom is doing. But this the stuff he kind of cobbles together are like, they're little bits of like stage pantomime characters or like half remembered travel, like popular travel writing. Yes, he does ponder the economics of a real model farm in Palestine. We'll get to that in a future episode. But his Oriental daydreams have a distinctly indistinct atmosphere. These sensual fantasies center Bloom as the Julia Roberts in his own personal Eat, Pray, Love. He is a curious wanderer, a pilgrim in an eastern land that is exotic, yet oddly welcoming and comfortable, and with just enough menace thrown in to thrill.
A frisson.
A frisson?
Yeah, like, oh, there could be a thief down that darkened alleyway. Mm-hmm. I'll move on. Yeah.
Yeah. And people speaking in a dark language.
Mm-hmm.
And...
yeah.
Well, we'll look at some of these lines here now. So Bloom's Orientalist daydreams are usually triggered by something in his memory or environment. And I think it's often something that does, like, cause him some emotional pain. Mm-hmm. And I do think this is his kind of personal salve for moving on, just repressing those bad thoughts. Think about the nice things. Molly is a painful thought, so I'm going to think about this mysterious, like, Aladdin adventure instead. So... I think Molly is a big trigger for this one right here in Calypso. Man, the first time you read through this, you wouldn't know any of this.
Hmm.
But, you know, that's why you should reread Ulysses, guys. If this is your first time through, so much more makes so much more sense than the second time through. Bloom is kind of thinking about Molly's breakfast just before this passage. He says,
Boland's bread fan delivering with trays are daily. But she prefers yesterday's loaves, turnovers, crisp, crowns, hot.
Right, he's literally just thinking about bread because he sees a bread van. But then this particular tangent, we can see through this, just she dumped in there, that's inspired by thoughts of Molly that begin very subtly, but then become more explicit towards the end when he compares her new garters to the color of the night sky and wherever the scene is set. He says,
night sky, moon. Violet color of Molly's new garters.
Right, and it's kind of sexy too, right? He has already reflected on her girlhood in Gibraltar, if you remember, like, forgotten any little Spanish she knew, and thinking about her lying in bed. The bed came all the way from Gibraltar, got it at a short knock at an auction from the governor of Gibraltar. We talked about that in the Tweety episode. Yeah, we've talked about her father, old Tweety, and his connection to Plevna. Which, if you haven't listened to our Major Tweety episode, that's a city in northern Bulgaria and a site of a siege during the Russo-Turkish War. So that's, you know, Orient enough for our purposes. So a loosely defined Orient, like I said, can include Gibraltar and Bulgaria. So Bloom is, that's what these are triggering in Bloom's imagination. Like, as a 30-something living in 2021... this was completely opaque to me because I don't think of those as being the Orient. Mm-hmm. I think of them as both being in Europe, but how times have changed. But this is Bloom connecting these dots of this mysterious Orient. Notice, too, that old Tweety shows up again just before these quoted passages. Bloom's thinking about him buying the bed at an auction in Gibraltar. And only a moment before Bloom really, like, plunges into the depth of his fantasy, he describes him as...
old Tweety's big mustaches leaning on a long kind of spear.
Right. So Molly and her father are this symbolic connection to the East. And honestly, I think Molly's origin in Gibraltar is kind of a turn-on for Leopold. He finds her, quote, Moorish qualities rather exotic and sexy. Mysterious Eastern women certainly figure into Bloom's various fantasies. You know, much later in Circe, he describes Molly dressed in a yashmak, which is a traditional Turkish item of clothing. And in Nausicaa, he refers to her directly as Moorish. He says of Molly,
that's where Molly can knock spots off them. It's the blood of the South, Moorish.
Right, and this would make you think Molly is...
Arabic or, you know... Berber or somewhere from North Africa, Tuareg, yeah.
Maybe a Muslim?
Yeah, Muslim, yeah.
She's definitely not. She is Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
Her father's from Ireland. Her mother is Spanish. There's some people who think her mother is Jewish, but I don't think that's been confirmed.
Mm.
She's certainly not Moorish. Anyway, but once Bloom kind of gets into his daydream full tilt, we begin to realize that Bloom's view of the Orient, of these carpet shops... and dark language are kind of more suited to like a child's adventure story or a comic book than to real life in that part of the world. More precisely, we do see specific pop cultural influences in his fantasy, specifically stage pantomimes. How would you describe a pantomime? This is probably a word that's unfamiliar to any American listeners.
That surprised me when I found out. Yeah. Like a pantomime would be, I'd associate it with Christmas, like a theater, live theater show, Puss in Boots, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Very childish, very simple stories, usually with a lot of audience interaction. Mm-hmm. So the hero will yell at, he's behind you, and then the audience will go, oh no, he isn't, oh yes he is, and there's a back and forth. And it was charming but silly.
Did you ever see any that had like Sinbad the Sailor or any other like?
The only one that I can remember as a kid sing was Puss in Boots. I don't remember. I might have, but I don't remember.
All right. Well,
yeah. The really sophisticated ones that have wire work for Peter Pan and stuff like that. Yeah. But that was way above our pay grade.
So a lot of these plays in Joyce's era did feature Orientalist characters like Sinbad or Turko the Terrible, who is not remembered as nearly as much as Sinbad the Sailor. He was very famously portrayed in that era by actor Edward William Royce. Stephen even recalls his mother laughing at Royce's portrayal of Turko in Telemachus. So Turko pops up more than once in Ulysses. He also, like we said, pops into Bloom's Orientalist fantasy in Calypso, where he describes
big man, Turko the Terrible, seated cross-legged, smoking a coil pipe.
Like, he could be in, like, the opening sequence of Aladdin, Disney's Aladdin.
Yep.
Yeah. If you want to see a really excellent and, you know, at least within my lifetime recent example of Orientalism, Disney's Aladdin. There's one point when I was researching this where I realized I had stopped reading and was just watching clips of Aladdin on YouTube. But it's got everything. It's like a checklist. Anyway, as Telemachus and Calypso both take place at roughly the same hour of June 16th, we could think of Turko as representing, remember that hypostasis, the joining of two aspects of God, father and son, merging of minds, Bloom and Daedalus, they're both thinking about Turko the Terrible.
Okay.
So Turko could be a symbol of hypostasis. If you'd like to know more about that, listen to our episode called Who is this Dan Occam Fellow Anyway? I don't want to talk about hypostasis ever again. They're both reaching for a symbol of the Near East, and they both come up with a pop culture figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even highfalutin intellectual Stephen
comes
up with Turko the Terrible. Bloom's fantasy in Calypso is also influenced by F.D. Thompson's travelogue In the Track of the Sun. He mentions it by name here. We've talked about this a little bit before, but it recounts the author's journey from New York through Egypt, Palestine, India, China, Japan, and Ceylon. Bloom says,
probably not a bit like it, really. Kind of stuff you read in The Track of the Sun.
So Bloom is aware enough, just as we readers are, that all that like Turko the Terrible stuff is kind of silly.
Yeah.
In Ithaca, we get to see Bloom's bookshelf, and we learn that he owns a copy of In the Track of the Sun, though his copy is missing its cover. And so Bloom references a girl with a dulcimer that might be based on that title page, which we point out in the past shows a young woman playing a Japanese instrument called a shamisen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what it might be referring to most directly. But I think it's also an allusion to the Samuel Taylor Coleridge poem Kubla Khan. Have you read Kubla Khan?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What would you say about Kubla Khan?
Well, it's famously, allegedly, the result of a dream.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's just this tumble of imagery and doesn't have like a coherent narrative thread to it, but it's beautiful. It's pretty. I know you don't like it, but I've always
liked it.
It wasn't
for me. No, I remember you told me you thought he was out of his gourd on laudanum when he wrote it.
Yeah, that's, well, there's a movie called, if anyone can find it, there's a movie called Pandemonium, and a Daemonium. And it's a very far-fetched version of the writing of Kubla Khan. Extremely far-fetched. Mm-hmm. It's got some wonderful scenes of laudanum hallucinations. And William Wordsworth is the villain. He's the Salieri character, and he's really horrible. And I don't like Wordsworth anyway, so that's great. Yeah. No, it's a good luck finding it.
All right. Well, in Kubla Khan, there's no shamisen, but there is a dulcimer. We'll read that line in a moment here. And because a shamisen and a dulcimer really look nothing alike, it's likely that this is a hint to the Kubla Khan illusion. Mm-hmm. So it's a dreamlike poem that's inspired by 1001 Nights. All right. That so far so good. Coleridge describes Kubla Khan's paradise-like palace, Xanadu, as a land, quote, where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree, and, unquote, and where you might hear a, quote, woman wailing for her demon lover. Check, check, check. Check all those boxes on the Orientalism checklist. Coleridge also describes...
A damsel with a dulcimer in the vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora.
Mount Abora, not a real place. Mark that off the checklist too. Maybe we should make an Orientalism bingo card or something like that. Don't play an Orientalism drinking game during this podcast episode because you will die of alcohol poisoning. Anyway, I think that's where the dulcimer comes from.
Yeah,
it's kind of a mishmash of both In the Track of the Sun and Kubla Khan stuck together because Blim doesn't remember everything real clearly. It all kind of, you know, rolls together in his head. Blim's vision of the Orient has been romanticized and filtered through an imperialistic point of view. It's worth noting his Orient is vague, expansive. It offers him a glimpse of a world of robbers, strange music, and demon-haunted women, right? It's kind of sexy. Blum's vision of the Near East, as seen in Calypso, is very much tied into the travelogue vision of the Orient. Mm-hmm. It's fueled by his attraction to, quote-unquote, Moorish Molly. His understanding of Oriental women, whether a shadow in a fantasy or his own wife, is all a product of bourgeois British culture. Blum is self-aware. He knows that his fantasies are BS. He's just having fun. He quickly rejects his own thoughts. But while this Orientalist motif arises in various forms throughout the course of Ulysses, none of the characters in Ulysses, it's worth noting, have ever been to the Orient. Mm-hmm. And the closest is maybe Molly and Gibraltar, but their quote-unquote knowledge of the East is based entirely on words, hearsay, stereotypes, books that they've read. None of them have ever actually experienced it, but it influences them all in some way. So even very worldly characters like Stephen Dedalus or the mystic A.E. Russell have never experienced the Orient directly in any way. So they're all, even the smartest people we meet, are relying on the same secondhand information as the rest of their Dublin cohorts. This experiential gap extends to and includes their creator, James Joyce. So it's an intellectual fantasy, but it is a fantasy nonetheless. The vision of the Orient held in this novel. And it's not trying to be realistic, and I think thematically in Ulysses it doesn't need to be or want to be.
No, it would reflect the ideas mm-hmm. that people had.
Exactly, yeah. But it was such a powerful idea and so common in the popular culture of the day in both books and pantomimes and music mm-hmm. that it was just very, everybody, it was just kind of steeped in this vision of the East.
Yep.
And for Blum, it's particularly fascinating. He's really spellbound by it. And what makes it especially interesting is that Blum is an Irish Jew, which sets him at the crossroads of the cultural conflict caused by this Orientalism. Because in the eyes of many people in this time, Anglo people at this time, Blum would be an Oriental person, which I know is not the preferred use of Oriental, but bear with me here. Blum is from the Orient. Many commentators I found when I first started researching this are very quick to point out Blum as the epitome of the Oriental man due to his Semitic heritage, which was bizarre to me. I've never thought of Jewish people as from the Orient. Mm. That's something I learned from reading about this, right? And within the text of Ulysses, Blum does appear symbolically to Stephen as Harun al-Rashid, a character from 1001 Nights, sort of a central figure to the pop culture Orient of their day. Pay no mind to the fact that our Harun al-Rashid, or that the real Harun al-Rashid, was not a Jew, but the kind of close enough attitude of this portrayal shows the way the Orientalist worldview blurs cultures together.
Right.
The only two differences are us, normal, logical, sensible, and them, weird, sexy, mysterious.
Yes. Enjoy your new existence in the blender.
Yeah. It's wild to think. Blum, who casually imagines this adventure in a generic Orient, surmises that his wife's personality is a product of her, quote, blood of the South, is orientalized in turn by the denizens of Dublin throughout Ulysses. So he has this mind. This is why I found that comment about, like, the chauvinism of imperialism or whatever. Like, it's in everyone's mind, mm-hmm. right? Bloom stereotypes this idea of the Orient, and the people around him are all thinking the same thing about him, that he's from there, from this place he knows nothing about, and has like a cartoon worldview about. People think like, oh, that's him, he's an Oriental. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really weird. A few examples of this. In Nausicaa, Gertie McDowell's infatuation with Bloom is based on him being, quote, a foreign gentleman. How exotic. All the way from Eccles Street to Sandymount. In Circe, J.J. O'Molloy defends Bloom by claiming,
his submission is that he is of Mongolian extraction and irresponsible for his actions.
And even Molly Bloom gets in on the act, thinking in Penelope that Bloom sleeps, quote, like that Indian god he took me to show one wet Sunday in the museum in Kildare Street.
That was the Buddha statue?
The Buddha statue, yeah. We'll talk about him in Lotus Eaters when he gets mentioned. Yeah, so Bloom orientalizes Molly. Molly orientalizes Bloom. And if we add to this that Bloom is ethnically Hungarian, it just adds to the stew, because it was once erroneously believed that Hungary was founded and named for Attila the Hun, an invader from the east. So even his Hungarian ancestry made Bloom a kind of Oriental in some people's eyes in that time period as well. Mm-hmm. So that I've now tied all the Orientalist knots. That's all I got. What do you think?
Yeah, it's wearying, isn't it?
It is wearying, because it's all nonsense. It's all like the In the Track of the Sun stuff, or the, you know, Bloom's fantasy.
Well, we don't do that these days. We're much better than now. We're so much better than them now. Yeah.
Just our vision of what, quote unquote, the Orient is like has changed. It's not like this. It's not quite this, but we've just drawn a different cartoon.
Yeah. Yeah, just new phantoms come up.
Even people who've lived in, Westerners I've known who've lived in Asia for decades still do it. Like, it's, mm-hmm. yeah.
They never drop.
It runs very, very deep.
It's Freudian censorship and projection. And this pitiful thing about it is when you do that to yourself, it's the sort of academic liberal way of looking, oh, this is incorrect. No, you're the only person you're wounding here is yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, the first person you're wounding is yourself. Because you're putting a screen between you and reality, and then you're censoring the incoming information, and you're projecting outwards onto the external reality, and you're creating a hologram, mm-hmm. instead of dealing with the reality that's right in front of you. And that's kind of sad. And I would say, and I'm going to say it, a lot of Americans go to Ireland and they do the very same thing there. It's a sort of Occidentalism, mm-hmm. one writer called it.
Celticism is one term I saw. I think the guy who wrote the paper I was reading and coined it, but that is a, at some point we'll come back to that, because when I wrote this as a blog post, it ended up being a two-part post, and the first post covers a lot of what we talked about here, and then the second post has very little Ulysses in it, but it's more of like a context building post of how the Irish saw them in turn, because we've talked a lot about the British here, and that, you know, as we said, Venn diagram, all that,
yeah,
but there is a very peculiar Irish take on Orientalism that separates them out from the British. And I don't want to say any more than that about it, but I called that post, Is Leopold Bloom Phoenician? Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't tantalize you, well, then I guess nothing will. All right, so go read that, Is Leopold Bloom Phoenician? I know he's not, you guys.
It's called Betteridge's Law. If a headline ends with a question mark, the answer is no.
So all the people on Facebook when I posted that who were like, no. Yeah, I know, but like, read the post. I worked really hard on it.
RTFM. Yeah.
All right. So that's what we're going to end on today, is read the post. Mm. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. I'm not going to spoil the next episode, but it's going to be out of the ordinary, and I am stoked.
Oh, yes.
And if you want a preview of that, you better sign up for that newsletter, which they can find at
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
All right. See you in the funny pages, kids.
Bye. Bye. Ooh.
for listening to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. Your support means the world to us. You can subscribe to Blooms and Barnacles on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other place you listen to podcasts. You can also stream our episodes at our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles.com. If you've enjoyed our podcast, you can do one of three things to help support us. Number one, please donate at bloomsandbarnacles.com. The PayPal donate button is at the upper right-hand corner of the page. This helps us pay for coffee and for hosting fees. Two, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. This helps more people find our show. And three, share us with a friend who you think would enjoy Blooms and Barnacles. Blooms and Barnacles is also a blog. We post new articles and original artwork semi-regularly at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Never miss an update by following us on social media. Search for our group, Blooms and Barnacles Podcast, on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at BarnacleCast. You can also send us an email at bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. We met some of our favorite podcast friends through random emails and social media DMs. We'd love to hear from you too, so don't be afraid to shoot us a message anytime. We'll be back in your feed in 2 weeks. Bye for now.